Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I love selling at the farmer's market, and I love the farmer camaraderie. It's sort of the modern day equivalent of what might used to happen maybe at the grain tower in the mornings, you know.
But what farmer Jody Ellett doesn't necessarily enjoy is all the preparation and time that goes into selling her food at market. A local food hub would give her more opportunities to sell her harvest with less organizational work. We'll play a snippet from that interview along with three other selections from interviews we loved from 2012. After that, we speak with Matthew Locricchio about how to get teenagers to be more adventurous eaters. And in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr fires up the oven to make thin crust pizza pies. Stay with us. There's no news segment this week. Our bloggers are still enjoying a much-needed vacation. So check out our Twitter feed for the latest headlines, twitter.com/EarthEats. Every year, over 100,000 American horses are eaten abroad. We stopped slaughtering horses in this country 5 years ago. But since then, we export live horses to slaughterhouses in Mexico and Canada. From there, most of the meat goes to the European Union. But many American horses are given drugs, drugs that people shouldn't consume. Jack Rodolico reports for Harvest Public Media and Latitude News.
New York native Ken Terpenning fell in love with horse racing as a child. But it wasn't until he moved to Kentucky that he got involved with the sport. Terpenning knows what makes a winning horse.
Silky Shark was everything you want in a racehorse. He was vibrant, fiery, a very happy horse. And then on the racetrack, he earned over $100,000 career-wise.
Official winner of the ninth race, number one, Silky Shark.
Silky Shark was an athlete, but he had some medical problems. Under Terpenning's care, the horse was given a drug called phenylbutazone, or bute. It's an anti-inflammatory drug used so commonly it's referred to as horse aspirin. But bute is also a human carcinogen, so dangerous authorities in the U.S., Canada, and the European Union agree. Humans should never eat a horse given bute.
Silky Shark ended up going to a feedlot operator, a meat dealer.
Meet Seneca Crossland, executive director of the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. Her organization tracked Silky Shark's records. Despite his drug history, the horse was slaughtered and his meat got past the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. The CFIA refused to comment on this story. Here again is Ken Terpenning.
Oh, I was totally devastated. Cried for probably 2 or 3 days.
Silky Shark's story shines a light on an industry operating in the shadows. When Terpenning couldn't afford to care for Silky Shark anymore, he sold the horse to a man he trusted. But then the horse was resold multiple times, winding up on what's called the slaughter pipeline. In 2011, the year Silky Shark was slaughtered, this happened to about 140,000 American horses. Not all of them were racehorses either. And it's reasonable to assume many of them would have been given drugs at some point.
Horses have not been raised as livestock. They have been raised often as companion animals. They're given drugs when they need them. People aren't holding back.
But who eats horse meat anyway? Belgium, France, and Italy, for starters. The European Union is the primary market for American horses slaughtered in Canada.
I fear that this horse represents a larger problem.
Dan Jorgensen is a member of the European Parliament. He's right. In 2010, a Tufts University study tracked 18 American racehorses that were all dosed with bute, all sent to slaughter. And just a few months ago, Belgian inspectors found the same drug in horse meat imported from Canada.
Well, I think it's quite concerning that European consumers might actually be buying and, well, eating horse meat that we don't really have any reason to believe is healthy.
Things are different in the European Union. Over there, every horse has a passport. It's a physical document recording the horse's drug history. But the EU has had a tough time enforcing those standards outside of its borders. Jorgensen says that has to change.
This is just a question of the European Union wanting to really do this. If we really want to put pressure on Mexico and Canada and the different individual companies that are actually doing this trade, we can.
Pressure on Canada and Mexico will mean change in the U.S. We don't track the drug history of horses in this country, which means virtually none of our horses pass the EU sniff test. Plus, the U.S. doesn't even have jurisdiction on drug residue because we aren't slaughtering the horses. So, should we reopen horse slaughterhouses in the United States?
I don't know. I don't want to get into that can of worms.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Grandin worries if the EU cracks down, the U.S. will be left with hundreds of thousands of unwanted horses. And most Americans don't want any horse to be slaughtered, period.
Well, I don't know what we're going to do. We got to do something. You know, and if they don't want to have slaughter facilities, then they're going to need to have a lot of rescue places because there's going to be a bunch of horses starving out there.
So the U.S. is left with a problem. And horse lovers, the people who could petition the federal government for change, are split right down the middle on how to fix that problem. Until something changes, every week, a couple thousand American horses will be slaughtered in Canada and Mexico. Horses like Silky Shark. Ken Terpenning, back in Lexington, Kentucky, hopes someone in the U.S. creates a database to log every drug given to every American horse.
I just wish it was done. You know, I look at his pictures on my wall every day, and I just still can't believe it.
For Harvest Public Media and Latitude News, I'm Jack Rodolico.
Latitude News is a website that localizes the globe. This story comes to us with support from the Public Radio Exchange and the Open Society Foundations. We're settling in to 2013 around the Earth Eats offices. Just like the folks in food service, it's now, after the holidays, when we can relax and reflect and take a breather. So today we're looking back at four of our favorite interviews from 2012. We'll start off with Gene Bauer, president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. He visited Bloomington, Indiana in the spring and made time for us to talk about his work protecting farm animals. One of his suggestions for those wanting to eat ethically raised meat is to understand what those labels on our food actually mean.
In many cases, you have animals that are raised and slaughtered, and they're being marketed in a way that sounds a lot better than it is. You know, the term free range, for example, makes people believe that these animals are outdoors free ranging. But free range only requires that animals be given access to the outdoors, and that's not defined. So you often have animals raised in warehouses with a small door that goes to a crummy little paddock, and that's technically free range when it doesn't really meet what most people would assume free range meets. So I think if people are going to buy animal foods, it's important to get to know the farmers, ideally go to farmers markets, maybe even visit the farms to see what's happening, because a lot of times these labels are very misleading. In an ideal world, we would not be killing and eating other animals, in my ideal world. But you know, each person has their own opinion and may have another vision of what the ideal world looks like. But from my standpoint, killing is an inherently violent act, and it's one that we don't need to engage in. But I also recognize that everybody has their own opinion. What I would encourage, though, is that people make decisions about their food that are aligned with their own values and aligned with their own interests, instead of saying, don't tell me, I don't want to know, which is too often what people say when they hear about factory farming or when the topic comes up.
Right at the start of the summer farmers market season, we spoke with Jody Ellett, farmer and board member of the local Growers Guild. With the increasing demand for local food across the country, small farmers are trying to figure out even more ways to serve customers. That's where local food hubs come in. Food hubs are places where local food from a variety of producers is aggregated, graded, processed, packaged, and then delivered to area buyers, whether they be restaurants, wholesale markets, or individuals. Ellett says a local food hub isn't going to compete with large distributors. They're meant to give locally minded consumers another option and give farmers more avenues to sell their harvest.
A lot of these distribution companies aren't just carriers of food. They have the paper towels, the soap, the everything that the restaurant needs, and it's very convenient for a restaurant to do one-stop shopping. I don't blame them. And so what a food hub of local food can provide is at least a mechanism for a restaurant to have another option. It may take a little extra effort on the part of the buyer, but not as much as it's currently taking. There are a few professions where people have to be so versatile, you know, and so skilled in so many areas. I love selling at the farmer's market, and I love the farmer camaraderie. It's sort of the modern day equivalent of what might used to happen maybe at the grain tower in the mornings, you know. But the sort of time that you spend preparing and getting to market, selling at market, marketing your product, maintaining a website, maintaining a listserv, communicating with people individually and in groups, you know, is a very time-consuming thing, and that is an issue.
In August, Lynn Schwartzberg visited the Earth Eats studios to talk about barbecue. In addition to being a food writer, she's also an official judge for the Kansas City Barbecue Society, so she knows what the standard says a good rib should be. She started off by telling me that falling off the bone meat is way, way too overcooked. You want a rib where you can take a clean bite while the rest of the meat remains on the bone. Schwartzberg then went on to talk about how exactly you cook the perfect rib.
The first thing you need to do is prepare your slab, removing that silver skin from the back, or what we look at is that thin white film over the back of the bones. So when you remove that, it opens the backside of the meat to all of that wonderful flavor. Low and slow, they always say that with barbecue, and it is true. You want to start your smoker with hardwood charcoal and a nice slather of yellow mustard, which was the one moment where I thought, I'm not doing this. It is basically the foil for the flavor. The yellow mustard burns off. It imparts no flavor, but it gives that beautiful bark a place to start. So you slather on that yellow mustard and sprinkle your rub, whatever it is, whether you make it yourself, whether you purchase a rub from a championship team, whether you whatever that rub is, sprinkle it on. Too heavily, you're going to have such salty food, you're not going to want to eat it. And then let it smoke, low and slow. What I learned, actually, though, is once the meat gets to a certain point, you can bring it inside and finish it in the oven. What you don't want to do is start in the oven or start on the stovetop where people parboil and then finish on the smoker and think you're going to have a good product, because it doesn't work in reverse.
Then in the fall, a book came across my desk called The Happiness Diet by psychiatrist Dr. Drew Ramsey. It explores the relationship between diet and mental health. The cover features a juicy hamburger, which Ramsey says can be an integral part of a healthy diet. There are two ingredients on this burger that make it unique from its fast food counterpart: grass-fed beef and a whole grain bun.
So the reason those are important is a whole grain bun is going to have all the trace minerals that get lost when we refine wheat and we refine flour. In that outer shell that gets stripped off are where lots of the nutrients and particularly the trace minerals live. With the grass-fed beef is just a very interesting topic right now, I think. And grass feeding changes both the nutrient density of the beef, makes it more nutrient dense. Grass-fed beef, if they wanted to market it better, they'd call it low-calorie beef. a 6-ounce strip, a New York strip grass-fed steak has fewer calories and less saturated fat than a chicken breast. Red meat has really gotten demonized around the notion of saturated fat and cholesterol, and that it's a way that if you eat too much red meat, you're going to increase your risk of cancer and heart disease. And I really hope, as a psychiatrist, I want to add in there that people think about what really are the most dangerous diseases, which are going to be depression, anxiety disorders, dementia. I mean, there's nothing, you know, heart disease is a horrible disease, but it hits people later in life usually. When you see someone, an 18-year-old, kill themselves because of a bad depression, that is just a level of sort of tragedy and illness that is just devastating. And if there's anything we can do to prevent that with diet, and I think there's some data that you can, we should really be pushing that in mental health.
Listen to these complete interviews on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up...
I just love a fireplace, so I'm... They didn't call me Pyro for nothing. But.
Mary Lou Orr explores her love of fire. She assembles some fire-starting bouquets out of dried flowers, plants, and herbs saved from her garden. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Each week, we speak with authors of everything from cookbooks to food history books. This week, we chatted with chef Matthew Locricchio, author of Teen Cuisine. It's a cookbook aimed to make vegetarianism appealing to young people.
And I use names like Banana Slap and Banana Berry Blender Benders. And then one of my crowning glories in this book is something I called Make a Scene Pasta.
Looking beyond the silly names, the recipes are straightforward and healthy. He hopes this encourages families to make cooking an intergenerational activity. Here's 1 minute with Matthew Locricchio.
There really is nothing more important than providing good nutrition, whether it's coming out of your hands in the kitchen or you're exciting your kids enough for them to actually get in and start to cook. There are ways to save some time in terms of cooking. One of the things I suggest a lot of times to parents is plan a menu. Put together a menu for the week. Sit down with your kids and get them involved in the menu planning. Share the responsibility to go get the ingredients. Thinking all the time, the best thing that you're going to be able to do is cook your own food in your own house. Well, you know, it's funny. I teach cooking to kids a lot, and I'm always amazed at how willing they are to try things. And the big deal that I find is if teen chefs lay their hands on the ingredients and they're part of the process, either the shopping or the actual preparation, they're much more interested in trying it.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate the time.
Oh, I'm delighted. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Read more about Teen Cuisine by Matthew Locricchio on our website, eartheats.org. It's a chilly day in southern Indiana. Mary Lou Orr is surrounded by bunches and bunches of dried flowers, plants, and herbs. Instead of letting the dried bits from her garden compost back into the soil, she collected them in a large bucket and has found a creative use for them today.
Does anybody see where I put my red scissors?
She's assembling some fire-starting bouquets that will decorate the living room and then eventually be tossed into the fire to keep the flame going.
I just love a fireplace, so they didn't call me Pyro for nothing.
They called you Pyro?
Pyro, no.
So maybe this is a perfect craft for the kid in your family who's maybe a little more interested in fire than you'd like him to be.
What's fun about this is all those things that are still useful, but they're not prime, and you just kind of hate just to throw them in the compost. Like I've got some extra sage, dried sage in bunches that I didn't use, and the birds had eaten all the seeds out of the sunflower heads, but they look kind of nice in this arrangement. Yeah, and then you've got all these different herbs that have a nice fragrance when they burn. So that's just a double thing. And then last but not least, you got all those used ribbons that we're going to use to tie them up with at the end. And I've even got there a pretty old wreath, small wreath, that I'm going to use in the top of one of them. So it's kind of a nice way to not waste anything. So So now I'll get going in here. The idea is down at the bottom to have stuff that's really going to burn and doesn't look particularly interesting. So I've laid down my sack, which I have cut. I put the printing on the inside so that won't be noticed.
I guess, what are these?
Those are blackberry lilies.
So you got little blackberries. They're these beautiful, like, pale purple flowers.
Yeah.
Oh, the spiky one that always sticks to my pants. What's this one?
Yeah, that's teasel. There's oregano there. And this is nice. It's Russian sage, and it's still got its very fresh odor, and it's very pretty with the blue flowers. And then I kind of like to use the London Times, the Financial Times, because it's pink. And so I've saved some old ones of those because they'll be a little bit different in the thing. Now, see, I'm just folding it up like your local florist would do. Folding it around.
So everything in here is flammable, even this twine that you're using?
Oh, yeah. That I wouldn't use wire for that reason.
That is the sound of mighty hands tying some twine. So you're really stamping it down.
Yeah, because I'm going to get it inside a wine sack.
Oh, you got to do some more stamping then.
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to fit that in there? I don't know about that. I'm impressed.
There. Whoops, I don't want that.
ML spent most of the day out on the porch assembling these bouquets. Just gorgeous. And burning one of these did make the room smell even better than it already did, believe it or not. Check out a photo of ML and her finished bouquets on our website, eartheats.org. To the kitchen now with Mary Lou's son, Daniel Orr. During these cold days, cooking food that requires the oven is a great way to add some extra heat to the house. So we dug through the Earth Eats archives to find one of our favorite oven dishes, homemade pizzas. We're lucky in that we're baking our pizza in a $20,000 brick pizza oven today. I'm willing to bet, however, that most of you don't have access to one of those. But fortunately, you can get similar results in your own oven with a $5 pizza stone. The stone lets water escape even from the parts that don't have good contact with the hot air in the oven. So that's why there isn't a gooey undercooked spot in the center of your pizza crust. Chef Orr has a battery of ingredients ready for us to use on our pizza pies.
What we do is we get some local ground cornmeal from Wibbs Farm. You could also mix in some whole wheat flour, some buckwheat flour, a little bit of white flour. You could also buy some frozen dough and then just use that, roll it out with some local grains, and you're going to have a nice crispy crust. And what we go for here are the thin crust pizzas. So we want to roll this out really thin. And if you're having a group of friends over, a good thing to do is, like what I've done here, is we've rolled out several in advance. So then all we have to do is everybody can make their own pizza, and we can throw it in the oven, and we're good to go.
So this is going to be a fun interactive meal.
It's great for kids. Also, if you have people that you don't really know that well coming over, it's a good thing to serve them because they can make their own and you don't have to worry about anybody's, you know, allergies and all that kind of stuff.
And a good icebreaker for some conversation.
Yeah. The first thing we do is we take a little bit of olive oil and we put that on top of the pie dough. And what that does is it creates a little seal. So the sauce that we put on won't soak into the dough. A lot of times, if you want that real crispy crust, you don't want to have it soggy with a lot of tomato sauce. Okay, so I'm going to follow the olive oil up with some red sauce. Now, with these thin-crusted pizzas, what you don't want to do is to overload them, all right? Because you want that crust to stay really crisp and to be able to pick it up without having all of your toppings fall off. So it's very important you don't do too much sauce. Okay, and then you can look over here, and we have some of the wide variety of items that we can put on the pizzas. We have local sausage, we have pineapple, we've got kielbasa, we've got pesto, we've got mozzarella, fresh mozzarella, We've got olives, prosciutto, roasted beets, roasted fennel, wine, drunken figs, even mashed potatoes. Sometimes we put mashed potatoes and meatloaf
mashed
on it.
Mashed potatoes?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, anything that you have, it's always great to kind of clean out the refrigerator, you know, use up all of those ingredients. You know, you could even make a dessert pizza with some grated chocolate and some mascarpone cheese, maybe some fresh fruit on that, some strawberries. So, I mean, you can really go wild with it, and it's really up to your own imagination. Wolfgang Puck was famous for doing a sushi pizza. So he would do kind of a flatbread, and then he would put some arugula and some raw tuna and some caviar and different things on it, some sour cream. What do you think, Annie? What would you like on yours?
See, I'm eyeing those pineapples. I love pineapple pizza.
Okay, well, then we'll do what we call our spicy Latino.
Ooh.
Okay, so we have the pineapple. I'm going to chop up some chicken. And then we're going to put on what is called a sofrito, which is a Puerto Rican pesto, which has red and green peppers and some chilies and cilantro. Sofrito was used to start a lot of the sauces and stews, and it's kind of like the Italians use their pesto, but it has a little more spice to it. Okay, and then we're going to sprinkle some jalapenos. We're going to put a little Parmesan. Then we've got some smoked Gouda. Okay, and then we put it on the pizza peel. What I like to do is to have it get a little bit brown and crunchy around the outside. A little bit of chard. I think that really adds to the flavor. The inside's going to be a little bit less cooked. Now, with the spicy Latino, I like to garnish it with some nice big sprigs of cilantro, which you can kind of wrap around the pizza. And then we put a lime wedge on it. Okay, we're just going to cut it up into nice little bites. Okay, that's the spicy Latino.
What if I'd chosen, I don't know, the sauerkraut?
Well, what we do is we call it the Oktoberfest pie. It is kielbasa and sauerkraut and smoked mozzarella. We do a big red in honor of IU, which is tomatoes and fresh mozzarella, tomato sauce. And then we put some pesto in the middle of that. We do a Italian stallion, and that is with the drunken figs and prosciutto. And then some mascarpone, we put some fresh figs on at the end.
Let your creativity be your guide for this recipe. Send us photos of the pizza pies you assemble. Our email address is eartheats@gmail.com. And find lots of other awesome recipes on the website, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Jean Bauer, Eabon Binder, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Matthew Locricchio, Daniel Orr, Mary Lou Orr, Drew Ramsey, Lynn Schwartzberg, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. And thank you for listening. Till next week, happy eating, folks. I'm Annie Corrigan.